The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mingling with the rush hour traffic, Red Army armored personnel carriers on the streets of Moscow this morning, heading to the Kremlin. They first moved in at 4 a.m., the first sign of the coup d'etat that removed Mikhail Gorbachev from power. With tanks in Red Square...
25 summers ago, in August of 1991, I'd been a foreign correspondent in Moscow for nearly 4 years for the Washington Post. Mikhail Gorbachev, as the head of the Soviet Union, had gone about dismantling the old communist ideology and state control over everything from the economy to poetry, and the old guard was increasingly furious. There had been rumors of a coup for months, and finally, on August 19th, it happened. Tanks in Moscow, Gorbachev under house arrest, and without exaggeration, the fate of the world as we'd known it for decades hung in the balance.
President Bush calls the coup a disturbing development, which could have serious consequences on relations with the Soviet Union. Experts say the stage is now set for civil war.
But when it was all said and done, the coup failed, almost comically, colossally, more Marx Brothers than Dostoevsky. It was over in just 3 days, and that was the last gasp of old Soviet power. By the end of the year, the Soviet Union itself was no more. And for my money, the failed coup of 1991 was maybe the most important event of the post-war era. It resonates even today. Many Russians, Vladimir Putin among them, see the fall of the Soviet Union not as the beginning of some new democratic age, but as a tragedy, a loss of greatness and power. And today we're going to talk with people inside Russia and here in the United States about that coup and how it echoes today, even in our own presidential election. I had first arrived in the Soviet Union in 1988, and at that time we could only hire local translators and fixers who reported every week, I think it was Friday afternoons, to the KGB. But when that tight control finally broke down in around 1990, my colleagues and I hired a young journalist named Masha Litman as translator, researcher, and dispenser of office wisdom. Together, we covered Russian politics, the reform era of Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, and eventually the coup that nearly ended it all. Masha Litman is still in Moscow, a writer and political analyst. And I thought maybe we'd begin by having you describe the atmosphere in the spring and summer of 1991, because there certainly had been hints that something ominous was coming.
Yes, this is how I recall it, too. But I would start just a little bit earlier, maybe, leading to 91, was the time to many of us in Russia of euphoria over the suddenly expanding freedom. At first, the censorship being swept away by this avalanche of what people wanted to say for years. This euphoria lasted incredibly for months after months, in even, I would say, maybe 2 years at least, until finally, in 1990, there was a sense that something was going on in the opposite camp, in the camp of hardliners.
Now, at that time, I was getting ready to go home for good. My wife and I, Esther Fine and I, were getting ready to go home. And you and I went to see Alexander Yakovlev. Do you remember what happened?
Well, for all practical purposes, Alexander Yakovlev, who was one of the closest allies of Gorbachev, was saying that coup is imminent and a coup can happen any day now.
And like the brilliant reporter that I am, I did the following. I got on an airplane with my wife and my then baby child, and we went home and we landed in New York, turned on the television, and there were tanks going down Kutuzovsky Prospect, the street on which our office was. Tell me about the morning of the coup, what you thought about it. Just tell us about that experience.
We were woken up by a call from closest friends of ours who happened to be in California. I remember very well, they said, switch on television. You have a coup in Moscow. And my husband and I got up and we were standing in front of the television screen. I think we were holding hands, listening to the first statement of the coup plotters, which sounded so unmistakably Soviet. At that moment, we realized it would not be this easy ride, more freedom, more freedom, more freedom, until the communist regime falls. In the sense that we developed over the previous couple of years, that there is no reason to live in fear. These dreams are not coming true.
You know, I was back in Moscow in a day and was there to cover with you the complete dissolution of this coup after just 3 days. The coup plotters were disorganized. They were foolish. They were often drunk. It was the worst coup you could imagine this side of any you've seen in Latin America or in a Woody Allen movie. 3 days it collapsed. And after that, the euphoria returned. The euphoria was even greater.
It was indeed greater because there was this sense that we won, we the people. And it was a very rare moment, I think, in the Russian history. People came running to stand up against the hardliners. I think a most symbolic expression of it was a gigantic Russian flag, the tricolor flag as opposed to the Soviet red flag, a gigantic flag that was carried by many, many people along the streets.
These are people that came out in the tens of thousands to surround the parliament building of the Russian government. And you saw mothers and grandmothers and all kinds of people giving flowers to young soldiers, telling them that they couldn't possibly fire on their own people. Putin himself in 1989 was an intelligence agent living in Dresden and felt abandoned by Moscow. In 1991, he was already back in St. Petersburg. He claims that he resigned from the KGB, but I don't know that we believe today that he ever resigned as an intelligence agent, and certainly viewed the fall of the Soviet Union itself as what he called the greatest catastrophe in the history of geopolitics in the 20th century.
Yes, indeed. I think it is very important about President Putin that he did not live through 91 with us. He happened to be in Dresden as a KGB officer. So he did not live through the hope and the euphoria. Maybe even if he had lived through it, he would not have shared it. He had this very bitter sense when he came back to Russia, and nothing of the euphoria and the happiness and the hopes of Gorbachev perestroika and then victory over the hardliners.
I can't help thinking that one of the analytic mistakes that we made in 1991 is that somehow all these institutions, these Soviet institutions, would somehow magically reform themselves. The Communist Party withered away, but the KGB became a center for economic power and entitlement in the new Russia to such a degree that a lot of the people around Putin are people who are ex-KGB or present KGB, and at the same time, oligarchs and big figures in what's called Kremlin Incorporated.
Indeed, and this in Russia was different from countries such as Poland or Czech Republic, which had Soviet armed forces as an occupying force. To them, there was a very clear sense. We want to get rid of the occupying Soviet force, and we want to regain our membership in Europe. And Europe, of course, came to help.
A lot of Russians blame the United States for not helping nearly enough. And I think Putin is included in this number, that they see the United States as gloating about the end of the Cold War, victory in the Cold War, and doing nothing to help Russia, which had cooperated so much, after all, in its own the dissolution of communism, starting with Gorbachev.
I think from the very beginning, there was, I think, a lot of triumphalism. There was a lot of lightheartedness about what happened. And there was the ambiguity. On the one hand, Russia was welcome as a fledgling member of the democratic realm. But at the same time, Russia was seen as a threat. But Russia at the same time also had a fear of NATO, which was, I think, very natural. NATO had been the enemy, so Russia had its own fear, which the West actually dismissed. The Eastern European nation were paid attention to, and they said, yeah, we realize you are afraid and we will expand NATO, which was seen in Russia as something that that meant that the West was against Russia, not against communism anymore. And this ambiguity, I think, made it even more difficult for the development after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
I'm going to be talking later in this program with Svetlana Alexeyevich, who's compiled and written a book called Secondhand Time, which is a compendium of, I would say, post-Soviet pain and disorientation. It's one interview after another with one person after another who describes what it was like to live in the kind of fantastical society known as the Soviet Union under communism. And then when that's erased, they've lost all their ideals, no matter how perverse those ideals may have proved. They lose their economic standing because suddenly all that system breaks apart. They're disoriented. They're in pain. They're resentful. They're angry at everybody from Mikhail Gorbachev to every American president you can imagine. How do you react to a book like that? What does it capture that you see as accurate, and what is it maybe missing?
Well, it's accurate in many ways. However, it creates a sense that everything about what happened was a big disaster making people unhappy. And I do not subscribe to that. The transition was very difficult in all the communist countries. Problem is that in other countries, there was this sense of, you can say, constructive nationalism. We are now on our own. That we're moving in the right direction. We are European again. In Russia, there was nothing like that. To say that we're now moving toward democracy was an empty sound. People to that said, we wanted democracy to make our lives better, not worse. So whoever would be able to address the people and say we are back on our historical, traditional track again, and this was Vladimir Putin, who said, I assume the responsibility, I will protect you from the insecurity of this new life, of this new period. Don't mess up with politics. This is not your business. Not exactly in these words, but he was sending this message to the people. That, combined with the growing price of oil during Putin's first decade, created a sense that now we are on the right track. This was the foundation of Putin's rule.
I think it's fair to say that you are a member of that species that's called a Moscow intellectual. You can't protest it, but you're in contact with the country. You travel around. You're in all kinds of circumstances. And when you talk to people, do you sense that the opinion polls are reflected in the way they talk generally about Vladimir Putin?
I think Putin's rating is genuine. It is very rare to run into somebody who dislikes Putin and would say somebody else would be better for Russia. It is interesting, however, that when people are asked who Putin represents, does Putin represent people like yourself? People rather say no. They think of him, they see him as representing the rich, as representing state security and what in Russian is referred to as siloviki, people with power, armed forces, the police, the prosecutor's office. It is important to remember that in Russia, Putin is regarded not just as a chief executive, he is regarded as the embodiment of the Russian statehood itself and as a safeguard of Russia's stature on the world scene. There is pride in Russia's military force. There's pride in Russia's past. There's pride in Russia's stature in the world. And all these have grown in the past 2 years since the annexation of Crimea. And I think people see Putin as the guarantor of that.
Masha, thank you.
My pleasure.
Masha Lipman speaking from Moscow. She's the editor of the Russian language journal Counterpoint. You can find her stories about Russia and its politics for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org.